Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Hello, welcome to another edition of Little Atoms. Tonight, just with me, Neil Denny, and I'm welcoming back to the show, after a gap of about 14 months, Manjit Kumar. Manjit Kumar has degrees in physics and philosophy. He was the founding editor of Prometheus, an interdisciplinary journal that covered the arts and sciences, described by one reviewer as perhaps the finest magazine that I've ever read. He has written and reviewed for various publications and currently writes for The Guardian, The Times, The Independent and New Scientist. Manjit's book, Quantum, Einstein, Bohr and the Great Debate About Nature of Reality, was shortlisted for the 2009 BBC Samuel Johnson Prize and was one of the top 10 science books of 2010 on Amazon.com. Manjit, welcome back to Little Atoms.
It's a pleasure to be back.
So we should perhaps, I've got you back for a special reason, so we should perhaps talk about why you're here, because obviously we talked about quantum the last time you were on, but why are you here tonight?
Almost 100 years ago, on the 7th of March 1911.
On Monday.
Ernest Rutherford made the first public announcement of the nuclear atom. So basically here to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the nuclear atom, the atom we all learn at school, but also talk more broadly and more widely about Ernest Rutherford, the man and scientist.
So let's talk about who Ernest Rutherford was then. Let's talk about his early life. Where did he come from?
Well, Ernest Rutherford was born in New Zealand, in a small place called Spring Grove, which was on the north coast of the South Island. And that was in August 1871. He came from a rather large family. He was one of 12. I can't remember whether it was five brothers and six sisters or six sisters and five brothers, but he was one of 12. Mum was a school teacher, so from early on, the whole family sort of valued education. Dad did various jobs, but ended up being a sort of a prosperous flax mill owner. And the only one who showed real academic promise and went on to university and an academic career was Ernest Rutherford.
It's sort of an indication of how, I suppose even now, but back then, how what a new country New Zealand was and how small it was, in that he got only one of four academic scholarships or something to go to the university.
There's that famous exhibition in Crystal Palace in sort of 1851, something like that. But there was loads of money being generated out of that. And some of that money went on to, was used for scholarships. And a certain amount was set aside for scholarships for people from the sort of far-flung corners of the empire. And there were two sort of set aside for sort of like Australia and New Zealand. And there was only one for New Zealand. And Rutherford applied for it, didn't get it. But the guy who was awarded this scholarship decided to get married and not take up the scholarship. Now, Rutherford at the time was engaged. And he decided, actually, you know what? I'd rather take the scholarship, go to Cambridge, than, get married and stuff. So it was all quite fortuitous how he ended up in Cambridge in sort of 1895. But that's where he ended up. He was about 22, 23. He had an illustrious academic career back in New Zealand. And that got him to Cambridge.
Well, let's say, by the time he gets to Cambridge, and we'll sort of set the scene for where he is at Cambridge in a moment, but, yeah, he's already got a reputation as being quite a formidable researcher by the time he gets there.
Because one of the things that Ernest Rutherford did when he was a student research student in Christchurch in New Zealand, he started working on developing a wireless detector, an early form of a radio receiver, and he carried on, and that was work that he carried on and he brought with him to Cambridge, and that was the first work he started doing there. And he extended the range of his detector, and to show how far ahead of the field he was leading it. Marconi was, who later on we all recognise as the inventor of the wireless radio and everything. He was far ahead of Marconi. He was he was the world leader in wireless detection, and this was in his mid early 20s.
So let's as I said, let's set the scene. So he's over in Cambridge, and he joins J.J. Thomson's Cavendish Lab. So let's talk about who else is there, what else is going on at that sort of time. Where are we at this particular...
OK, well, in 1895, when Rutherford pitches up in Cambridge, he's going to be working on his wireless detector. So that's what he does. And he thinks, oh, there's a bit of money to be made here. He's not naive. He might be from New Zealand, but he's savvy. And he knows that actually there's a prospect of making some decent money. But it was a time when, unlike today, patents were rare. you know, in terms, especially in terms of researchers. Mm-hmm. And making money from research was not the dumb thing. You had to be someone like Lord Kelvin, mm-hmm. you know, the preeminent scientist in the British Empire, to make money out of your inventions and stuff like that. And so Thomson took Rutherford aside and sort of warned him that if he got around that he was interested in making money out of his work, it would damage his reputation mm-hmm. before he even had one. So Rutherford decided that actually he was going to put aside work on the wireless detector and start working on X-rays. Now, X-rays had only been discovered in 1895 and more publicly announced in 1896 at the beginning of it. So everybody all around the world was desperately rushing off in their labs and to try and have a look at X-rays. Thomson was doing that, and Rutherford joined him in the study of X-rays. And it was then that he started making his reputation as an experimentalist, because Rutherford and Thomson discovered the true nature of X-rays. The reason they were called X, no one knew what they were. But Rutherford and Thomson discovered that there were, you know, short, high-energy wavelengths. You know, they were like light. Light is in one part of the electromagnetic spectrum, and X-rays were at the very short, high energetic end of it. And so that was when Rutherford started making a reputation for himself.
So, you know, once he's got that reputation, he then gets a professorship at McGill University in Canada.
At the ridiculously young age of 27, mm-hmm. you know. The reason that happens wasn't because of his work on X-rays. It's just that after he's done the work on X-rays, things come thick and fast in the last decade of the 19th century, because Thomson, who's at the Cavendish, in 1879 discovers the electron. Mm-hmm. Now, you've got to remember at the time, even the atom, even the existence of the atom is up in the air, and people have been debating it endlessly for decades. So all of a sudden, you know, Thomson discovers something which turns out to be the electron. All of a sudden, you've got two particles. You've got an electron, you've got an atom. And so there's loads of excitement. And lots of people go off and start investigating properties of the electron and things like that. Rutherford starts working on another discovery that was made around that time in 1896. That was radioactivity. And what Rutherford does after his work on the wireless detector, his early studies on X-rays, is he identifies that uranium emits two types of radiation, alpha and beta. And he's the one who names them alpha and beta. And that seals his early reputation as an experimentalist. Later, a third is discovered called gamma rays. And that's what gets him his professorship at 27 at McGill University in Montreal.
Okay, so this is basically the first major discovery of his life, and it will lead him famously to win the 1908 Nobel Prize for chemistry, funnily enough, not for physics. But let's go back take a step a little bit further back, and like we'll talk about radiation. So, what is radiation? What is actually happening?
Well, we can see it through sort of Rutherford's mm-hmm. eyes and his contemporaries' eyes. You know, you've got something like uranium, mm-hmm. you know, compounds with uranium in them. They seem to be emitting these mysterious rays. Rutherford identifies two of them, alpha and beta particles. They don't really know what alpha and beta particles are yet, but they've given them names. They know there's two different types. It's not just one thing. You know,
is there an obvious difference?
Alpha particles later. So we're running ahead of ourselves here a little bit. Alpha particles later are identified by mm-hmm. Rutherford as helium nuclei.
Sure.
Which means they're helium atoms with their two electrons ripped off. Yeah, so Rutherford and a colleague of his, which we'll come to later.
We'll get to this later. But
beta particles is fast moving electrons. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's the character of the two. But what happens when Rutherford pitches up in Montreal, he knows, and he says this in a letter, that part of the reason he's been employed is to knock the shine out of the Yankees. You know, he's there to do, you know, first class research. Mm-hmm. And there's two major contributions he makes over the next 9 years that he spends in McGill. One, he comes up with, he discovers the idea of half-life. Imagine you've got a kilogram of uranium. Mm-hmm. You know, so Rutherford comes up with the idea, or discovers that if you have a kilogram of uranium, that the radioactivity will decrease, right, by half mm-hmm. in a certain time.
Sure.
And that's the same for every different radioactive element or substance, that its radioactivity will decrease in half in a given time, and he calls that the half-life. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things he comes up with.
So this is Rutherford's discovery?
This is Rutherford's discovery. Another way of looking at it is that if you've got a kilogram of uranium mm-hmm. in a certain fixed time, half of it will have decayed.
Yes.
You know, so there's both ways of looking at it, but they mean the same thing. So that's Rutherford's discovery.
So he's also then the father of basically all of sort of geological dating, carbon dating, that sort
Absolutely.
Of thing all comes from that
Absolutely.
Same discovery.
And the other thing he does while he's there in McGill with a colleague, a guy called Frederick Soddy, mm-hmm. who's just as young as he is, you know, he's a couple of years younger, and he's a chemist. They discover that between, you know, in their collaboration, that what radioactivity is the transformation, the transmutation of one element into another with the emission of an alpha or a beta particle. So you know, and Rutherford jokingly says, you know, to Soddy one day, don't say that out loud or they'll hang us as alchemists, because basically they discovered that radioactivity was a means by which one element was being transformed into another with the emission of these alpha and beta particles. It was an astonishing and fantastic discovery, for which they rightly won. Well, Rutherford rightly won, because he led the research in 1908, the Nobel Prize for Chemistry. Mm-hmm. And of course, he famously has said that, you know, all of science was either physics or stamp collecting, but he saw the funny side of being given the Nobel Prize for Chemistry.
So I actually, you know, wrote down the citation here. He won the Nobel Prize for his investigations into the disintegration of the elements and the chemistry of radioactive substances. So they definitely get the they make sure to get the word chemistry in there. So what he was actually studying then was the he talks about it being one element changing to another, and this was basically uranium gradually decays and becomes lead. Is that right?
Well, yeah. I mean, basically, you know, if you get radioactive elements, they if they're emitting alpha and beta particles in that process, they're being transformed from one element to another. Because if an alpha particle is a helium nucleus, you know, it's a helium atom with its electrons ripped off, then chunks of the old element, if you like, are disintegrating. Yeah, and so the old element's being reconfigured, transformed into a new one. And what Rutherford and Soddy were able to do was follow this chain of decay from, you know, A all the way through to Z for various elements. And they actually started off not with uranium, but with thorium. Mm-hmm. That's the investigation they did. But by 1908, which is, I know, where you want to head to, when Rutherford won the Nobel Prize, he was no longer in McGill. The work on half-life and the work on, you know, radioactivity as a transformative thing from one element to another had got him a professorship at Manchester. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he showed up in Manchester in May 1907. And this is the, you know, where he really begins to do... You know, he has a Nobel Prize, but his best work is yet to come.
Mm-hmm. So you're listening to Little Atoms tonight with me, Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Manjit Kumar, and we're celebrating the life and work of Ernest Rutherford. So, yeah, so he's now in Manchester. We're going to get on to his next great discovery and the thing that he probably is best known for. Let's take that quite sort of slowly. And you've already said that we're at a time, he's working at a time where we're not even really sure. I mean, you've just said that, you know, that Thomson had discovered the electron, but there are still people, we are talking about some quite big players here, Max Planck being one of them, who are actually pretty not convinced that the atom even really exists. Is that still the case at this time?
Well, I want to say just one thing before I just answer that question. I just want to give you a flavour of Rutherford, you know, and, you know, the impression that he would make on his colleagues and what sort of, you know. So I've got a quote here from a chemist who was around at the time, mm-hmm. called Wiseman. Mm-hmm. Now, Wiseman went on to become the first president of Israel. And this is what Wiseman says of Rutherford in Manchester, you know, in 1907, 1908, that early period. And he says, "Youthful, energetic, boisterous, he suggested anything but the scientist. He talked readily and vigorously on any subject under the sun, often without knowing anything about it. Going down to the refectory for lunch, I would hear the loud, friendly, rolling voice come up the corridor." Right? So you can see, you know, Rutherford's a big personality.
Big man.
He's a big personality. And, you know, he... In these days, we would talk about man management. Mm-hmm. You know, he knew man management. He knew how to sort of pair up two researchers, assign them a project, get them working together collaboratively. He created a real team spirit in Manchester. Right, and at this point, so when he shows up in Manchester, he has various ideas of things that he wants to investigate, and one of the things he wants to investigate is the scattering of alpha particles, mm-hmm. because in McGill he'd sort of witnessed this phenomenon whereby alpha particles being shot at a piece of metal that hit a photographic plate were a bit fuzzy. And so this time he assigned a guy called Hans Geiger, mm-hmm. who's about 25, he's German, who most people might recall from the Geiger counter, because he went on to then invent the Geiger counter for, you know, detecting radioactivity and what have you. So at the end of the sort of, you know, 1907, 1908, 1909, the atom is now pretty well established. You know, people believe that there are such things as atoms. The debate has been had, and most people now accept their existence, even Planck. You know, Planck had struggled with the whole idea of the atom, as many others had. But now there was a lot of experimental data. Work by Einstein in 1905 was also a clincher, mm-hmm. for which people might remember Einstein for relativity and things like that. But Einstein was also seminal in some of the ideas he came up about in terms of atomic dimensions and what have you. So in 1907, 1908, you've got Geiger, all right, and Marsden, who's a 20-year-old undergraduate, mm-hmm. you're being asked by Rutherford to investigate the scattering of alpha particles by sheets of metal.
Okay, so before we go on to describe that experiment then, if you're saying that this is a sort of an atmosphere where the existence of the atom has been pretty much accepted, let's perhaps talk a little bit about what models of the atom there were at that time. Okay, and I think the most commonly known one would be J.J. Thomson again's plum pudding idea of the atom. So what does he mean by that?
Well, Thomson had this idea. You had sort of like, you know, imagine you... I know I want to get away from food, but imagine you've got like a huge lump of dough, and we can think of this as a positive matter, and embedded in this sort of positive matter dough, if you like, are, you know, plums or raisins, and these guys are negative. And these are supposed to be the electrons, because the electron is negatively charged. If they're part of the atom is overall neutral, so therefore it has no charge. So if electrons have negative charge, somehow they've got to be embedded, or there's got to be a positive component to the element, to the atom. So, you know, there was various competing atoms, you know, and people took most of them not very seriously. But if you want to say, given Thomson's reputation, he was head of the Cavendish, he discovered the electron, so his model was taken more seriously than most.
So, okay, so now let's put ourselves in this position then. They're about to conduct this experiment, which is basically firing alpha particles into a sheet of metal. I mean, why are they doing that in the first place? Because the discovery of the smudgy sort of photographic paper is sort of an accident from that, isn't it? I mean, what are they actually trying to do? What's the experiment to do in the first place?
Well, I think, you know, it's one of those things. Sometimes it's, you know, curiosity-driven stuff. You know, Rutherford is seen something in Canada where he sees some sort of fuzziness on a photographic plate. He wonders why that is. He thinks there's some sort of deflections going on there. Let's just investigate the scattering of alpha particles by a sheet of metal. Right? So he doesn't really expect anything, right? He just expects, on Thomson's model, he expects alpha particles, right, being shot at a sheet of gold foil to pass through it. Yeah, to pass through it. And a few to be slightly deflected, ricochets, so they're slight deflections. Well, what Geiger, who initially does the first experiments, finds is that some of them are much, you know, scattered much more than you would expect.
The angle of deflection
is much greater than you might expect. And so Geiger asks Rutherford to assign this undergraduate, Ernest Marsden, a project, and Rutherford said, oh, let Marsden see if he can find, you know, any more sort of large-angle scatterings of alpha particles. So Marsden does this experiment, right, again firing alpha particles at sheets of gold foil, but this time, because they move the detector around at larger angles, they find actually some of them are coming straight back, something that you can't explain on the Thomson model, right, because you can't explain the fact that an alpha particle hits, you know, a Thomson model and somehow ricochets around these electrons and comes back. It's virtually impossible, according to probability, that all these tiny little scatterings would result in an electron in an alpha particle being sent backwards. So Rutherford, famously, when he hears the report by Marsden of what he's finding, says, you know, if you imagine those World War II movies when you see those big battleships with their big guns launching these big shells, and Rutherford says, look, it was almost as incredible as if you had a 15-inch shell and fired it at a piece of tissue paper and it came back and hit you. So that was the impact that Marsden's findings had on Rutherford. So he got him thinking about how could you explain, you know, what was going on here. You know, these alpha particles bouncing right back, a bit like a ball hitting a brick wall and coming right back and hitting you in the face, because Thomson's model should just have these alpha particles passing straight through, or maybe slightly deflected.
And so his theory is...
Well, so what happens? Rutherford scratches his head for 18 months, and Marsden and Geiger go off and do some more experiments with different sheets of metals, you know, platinum, copper, whatever it is, and they come back with more data, and Rutherford has this idea, right, which he thinks can explain these results, and he calls it, I've devised a better model than JJ, which is that the atom has a central core, and that contains most of its mass, and then most of its volume, empty space, and then there's electrons knocking around. Now, at this point, he's not saying electrons are moving in these orbits, a bit like, you know, you have the sun at the centre, so you've got the nucleus at the centre, with these electrons in these sort of planetary orbits around. He hasn't got that far yet, but he knows that the atom must have a dense, small central core in which most of its mass is concentrated, because that way it explains all the range of deflections that the alpha particles seems to be experiencing when they're sort of hitting these sheet foils of different metals.
And it explains it because most of those particles would just be passing through empty space. The vast majority of matter is made up of empty space. They would pass through. The odd one will have a direct collision. From that comes what you've already mentioned, this idea of the atom that everybody will picture, which is the, you know, like a planetary system. But immediately that's sort of like rebuffed, because there is a problem with that. So let's talk about why would there be a problem with the idea that electrons could orbit Right. A nucleus.
Well, it was well established in the 19th century by James Clerk Maxwell. He developed the electromagnetic theory. And, you know, it was established that if you have a charged particle moving in a circle, that particle will radiate energy. Because if you move in a circle, you're accelerating, mm-hmm. even though you're moving in a circle. So any particle that accelerates will radiate energy. Mm-hmm. And if it's radiating energy, it will spiral into the nucleus. So if you've got electrons orbiting this central nucleus, like take hydrogen, hydrogen has one electron. If that electron is orbiting the nucleus, according to Rutherford, it will spiral and collapse into the nucleus, so the atom collapses. But of course, you know, you look around, you know, there's a world out there that's not collapsing.
Yeah, and this would mean that matter couldn't exist.
Absolutely.
And sort of, I've heard this described that this, you know, if matter was created and that happened, it would just disappear, like almost instantaneously.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, it just doesn't work that way. But of course, you know. Rutherford didn't, you know, he took his atom seriously, but of course there's this flaw in it. Mm-hmm. Other people had spotted this flaw as well. So, you know, he famously goes to a conference in 1911. This is in the very, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 months after he's sort of made this announcement, right, of his atom at this meeting of amateur scientists in Manchester. You know, he puts the model forward of the nuclear atom. He goes to a conference, there's Einstein's there, everybody's there in Belgium, in Brussels. He doesn't even mention his atom, right? But then something very interesting happens the following year. In March that year, March 1912, young chap pitches up in Manchester because he's had a rough ride in Cambridge with Thomson, who he'd wanted to go and work with and found that he didn't get on, was Niels Bohr. Niels Bohr pitches up in Manchester because at Christmas in 1911 at Cambridge, Rutherford had been the guest of honour and he'd like what he saw. This man who was, you know, larger than life, who also was very generous in his acknowledgement and support of the work of others. So he wanted to transfer up to Manchester with what time he had left in Britain on a research fellowship and wanted to learn something about radioactivity. So when he pitches up in Manchester in March 1912, almost a year after Rutherford had come up with, you know, expanded his atom, he very quickly starts learning about Rutherford's atom. And by the summer, he thinks he's got a solution to fix, you know, to Rutherford's flawed atom. And what he does, he says, there are certain orbits that electrons occupy inside an atom in which they don't radiate energy. It was like a prescription. He just said, this is what happens. I can prevent them from radiating by saying so. And he did that by invoking the quantum, because this idea that energy comes in packets. So these electrons occupy certain orbits in which they don't radiate. And if they want to go from one orbit to another, he worked this out over a few months, you know, 18 months or so. If electrons go from one orbit to another, they do that famous quantum leap that we've all heard of. And the energy between two orbits, the energy between two orbits is equivalent to a quantum, a packet of energy, which an electron has to absorb if it's jumping up to a higher energy level, or it has to emit if it's dropping down to a lower energy level. So it was Bohr who fixed Rutherford's atom, and sometimes it's known as the Bohr-Rutherford atom, you know, and people began to take it, you know, very, very, not very seriously. It became the model of the atom that we have.
You should listen. Everybody should listen to our earlier Little Atoms interview with Manjit about quantum, his book, because this parallel story is what that's about, and Niels Bohr is one of the heroes of that story. But to end this show, I want to briefly talk about what is quite a surprising discovery, Rutherford's, you know, third major discovery. And I was sort of quite surprised to read this in researching it, that really, you know, Rutherford is the first person to split the atom, despite not really getting the credit for it.
One of the last things that Rutherford did, because in 1919 Rutherford moved on to Cambridge, where, you know, it seems only right and proper, given his illustrious career, he took over as head of the Cavendish from his former mentor and his former professor, J.J. Thomson. And Rutherford was in Cambridge from 1919 to 1937, when he died at the terribly young age of 66. And the last piece of work he did, real significant piece of work he did in Manchester, was splitting the atom, right? This was done during the war, you know, 1917, 1918. What he did, he fired his beloved alpha particles at nitrogen and actually found chunks were coming off the nitrogen nuclei. And famously, one day he was late, because he was doing sonar research during the First World War to detect submarines. And so he pitched up a committee meeting, and instead of apologising that he was late, he said, I have been engaged in experiments which suggest that the atom can be artificially disintegrated. If it is true, it is of far greater importance than a war, you know? But given the war, given everything else, I mean, he isn't really credited, or he isn't widely widely acknowledged as a person who first split the atom. That sort of tends to be identified with two guys called James Cockcroft and Ernest Walton, who did it in 1932, who were actually in Rutherford's Cambridge department and being inspired and motivated by Rutherford. But they used a particle accelerator, the world's first particle accelerator. Not like the HC in CERN, 25 kilometres long, costing billions. This was a sort of a small desktop thing virtually in which you had to crawl, one man could sit inside it. But they are officially accelerated particles to split the atom or the atomic nucleus. So they did it first artificially, if you like, using particle accelerators. Rutherford had fired alpha particles at them during the war and split it. So I think the credit lies with Ernest Rutherford there for splitting the atom.
We're out of time.
I was going to say very, very briefly, Rutherford once said, I was brought up to look at the atom as a nice, hard fellow, red or grey in colour, according to taste. You know, he did more than anybody else to change that.
Thanks for speaking to us today again.
Pleasure.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.